actually in the theater. It's actually, you're very lucky. This is the really beaten up laptop that I take all my notes on when I give actors notes when I direct. So usually when actors see this lit up, it strikes fear in their hearts. So I'm hoping that by bringing it here, maybe it'll make it a little nicer and my notes will not be as mean as they usually are. So they asked me to open with a poem or a story, and I get the privilege of going and talking to a lot of different groups and teaching young kids and college students and sometimes adults. And whenever I teach poetry, I teach this particular poem mainly just because it's like a universally, you just can't go wrong with Shel Silverstein, right? So if I could, I'm just going to read, so it's Where the Sidewalk Ends, and it's kind of a nice, yeah, see, right? You just can't go wrong. There is a place where the sidewalk ends and before the street begins, and there the grass grows soft and white, and there the sun burns crimson bright, and there the moonbird rests from his flight to cool in the peppermint wind. Let us leave this place where the smoke blows black and the dark street winds, winds and bends. Past the pits where the asphalt flowers grow, we shall walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and watch where the chalk white arrows go to the place where the sidewalk ends. Yes, we'll walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and we'll go where the chalk white arrows grow. For the children they mark, and the children they know the place where the sidewalk ends. So ever since I was 8 years old, I have been described as creative, which means for most of my life, people have been asking me to do funny things at parties. This has included singing, which I'm not great at. You're much better than me, although I do know all the words to that song. And most of Chorus Line. No, it's not you. It's telling jokes. It's also not my strong suit. And explaining to relatives how it is I'm going to make a living doing what I'm doing. Usually, if they ask me to do that last one, I offer to sing instead. I make theater. I started as an actor when I was in elementary school, before I even really knew what that was. All I knew was that I didn't have any pride in myself before I started doing that, which may sound strange since you might think a third grader doesn't need to feel pride, but I disagree. It's true that a lot of kids probably feel invisible. And that's how I felt until I walked out on stage for the first time, opened my mouth, and people listened. And I thought, oh, I could get used to this. You'll notice I said, I make theater. And that's because I've done a lot of making over the years. It really feels like making. I still act, but I also write. I have a small company. It's basically me and three folding chairs. If you'd like to donate, we're hoping to get a fourth. So I work with other companies, I produce, I solve problems. Sometimes I make the problems and then I solve them. When I first sat down to write a talk on a life in the arts, I really just considered writing, well, it's a really strange life, and leaving it at that. But there is a very spiritual benefit in devoting yourself to something creative, whatever that might be. For me, I keep coming back to the reality of being seen, of feeling understood, or of making the effort to be understood. After that very first play I was in, and if you're wondering, it was Bambi, and I played the owl, who is really the hidden star of Bambi. I mean, anyone can play Bambi, but if you can play the owl. I remember everyone looking at me differently after that show. I remember my family, my teacher, other kids my age. And I still get that look anytime I perform anything. And sometimes people come right out and say it. And what they say is, where did that come from? I have a day job. I work at a library. I run a book club at the library. In that book club, there is a really lovely woman. She's 96 years old. She looks fantastic because she reads. That's the secret. And she really marvels at creativity. And she knows I'm a playwright, and every book club meeting, she'll hold up a book and say, how do they do this? And what she means is, how do they come up with characters? How do they make up stories? How do they figure out what a fictional person is wearing, or what they're eating, or why they love who they love, or why they're doing what they're doing? And the very idea of make-believe is just astounding to her. Now, she told me that when she was younger, she very badly wanted to be an artist, but that her parents thought that would be a waste of time, so they wouldn't let her go to an art school. And she really loved to draw. A few years ago, I bought her some art supplies for Christmas, and she was so happy. And I thought it was because of the gift, but it turns out she was just happy that someone was encouraging her to do what she always wanted to do. She was in her late 80s at the time, and she told me nobody had ever done that for her before. So it's never too late. I'm very lucky because I am surrounded by people encouraging me to do what I love, and only a few people who suggest that I stop. Granted, those people are usually called critics, and they get to write entire columns about how I really need to hang it up. And I gotta say, some of them are very persuasive. But then the following month, they'll say I'm a genius, and then the next month, I'll be just okay, and then a genius again, and then maybe, why is he still at it? Now, history isn't my field, but I'm convinced that the arts must have been created first, and then therapy probably came right after that. So what is that spiritual benefit I mentioned? How have the arts given me a life that might otherwise have been less fulfilling? Well, for one thing, it has brought the most incredible people into my orbit. When people ask me what it's like to run a theater, I tell them that the most accurate representation I can think of that exists in our culture happens to be the Muppet Show. I have been the Kermit. I have been Miss Piggy many times. And a few times I've even gotten to be Waldorf and Stadler, who are those two old guys who just sit in the balcony laughing at how insane everything is. Theater people aren't all that different from Muppets, really. They're not quite human, and yet they're more human than regular humans. They're a little odd, but eventually if you're around them long enough, you just stop noticing how odd they are. And the chaos that follows them soon becomes kind of charming. The arts have brought people like that into my life, people to encourage me so I don't find myself forgetting what it means to be seen, to have a voice, to feel as though what I say has value. When social media first began exploding, and I think exploding is a really good word for it, there were a lot of think pieces about why all this was happening. Why were people suddenly so eager to put every thought and opinion out into the public forum? But theater people understood why, because people just want to be seen. They want a minute or two, usually more, where they feel important enough that people pay attention to them. And we all need that, and some of us spend our entire lives figuring out a healthy way to get it. The arts have taught me that there is no shame in going after what you want. When you're an actor, you have what's called an objective. You have something that you're supposed to want as a character, and other actors and your director and everybody's always asking you, what do you want and what are you doing to get what you want? And while sometimes that's a tangible thing, like I want a necklace or I want a house or I want a new car, usually you're instructed to go deeper than that, to think about bigger things you want, like love or power. And what you find out is that it's very useful to engage in thinking about what you want and why you want that. Because the belief is that in constantly remembering what you're after, you remember just what kind of person you are, and more importantly, who you want to be. In fact, we're often told when we act that it's fine to want the house and the car and the money, but that it's not interesting. That's the word you hear a lot. In theater, nothing is good or bad, but things are interesting and less interesting. It's less interesting to want material things. It's more interesting to want the approval of another person or the admiration or the affection of a parent or the trust of a friend or a connection to a total stranger. We're told that while there is a driving force inside you that moves you toward an identity, you find little pieces of that identity in other people, and little pieces of them exist within you. And you have to rely on other people to help assemble that really great puzzle. And we call that assembly collaboration. And if you fail over and over again in finding that identity, the art teaches you that the failure is actually very interesting, and that the art comes out of the failure. Often it's not very good art, which means you frequently are failing at failing. So what do? You keep failing. It's the only thing that makes sense. A theater teacher once addressed a group of students, I was one of them, and said that while he was very proud of all the students who had worked hard and never faltered and gotten hundreds on everything and straight A's and accolades and all that, he was equally as proud at those of us who had struggled. It was the first time I had ever heard anyone say, it's okay to struggle. We believe that art is in the struggle. It's in the failing. Success is lovely, but it's just less interesting. The arts have taught me that words are important, but they're meaningless if they don't come with that corresponding action. When a character says one thing but does another, audiences get very confused. In that way, the bar for what an audience will believe is higher when they're watching a play than when they're watching the news. It's taught me about compassion. I grew up in the church, the Catholic Church. We were always asked to imagine life in somebody else's shoes. Then I started acting, and suddenly I didn't have to imagine anymore. I've put on all kinds of shoes over the years and asked myself, what does this person want? And in other words, who are they? And what you learn very quickly is that we all want the same things, and our differences only exist in the ways with which we attempt to sort out how to get those things and put together the person we think we're supposed to be. Ultimately, we spend way more time being identical in our failure than we do separate in our success. And that's very interesting. The arts have also taught me how crucial it is to be a person of the world, to look when others look away, to learn, to ask questions, to ask more questions, to approach every interaction with the knowledge that everyone is trying to get to the same place I am, and that part of my job as another person or a scene partner or someone behind the scenes is to help them get there without worrying about how much they're helping me get there. Theater is about what you're giving to the other people in the room. And if you've ever done theater, especially if you're one of my actors and you've seen the glow of this laptop, you might sometimes get the note, you're in your head right now. And that's just a fancy way of saying, you're not giving anything. You're being selfish. It's only about you right now. Try having somebody yell that at you for 3 hours a night, and eventually it might start to sink in. Like failure, cost is a necessity. Everything in theater costs you something. And you learn what you're willing to pay very quickly. You get to do this behind the safety of a character, but pretty soon you start thinking of all the ways you pay for things in your day-to-day life. How you let somebody talk to you has a cost. How much you give of yourself emotionally to someone else. How much it takes to be vulnerable, to show sadness, to say what it is you really want to say. To sing. Singing costs you a lot. Unless you come see me sing, and then it's free. I might have to pay you. It's not about trying to spend anything. Being stingy is just not interesting. It's just about examining the cost and whether you're paying enough or too much. When I found out I was doing this talk, I had just decided to reread one of my favorite books on creativity. We just started a book club at my theater. We're not the fanciest theater, but we have a book club. You can join. We'd love to have you. And this is one of my favorite books on creativity, and there's a story in it that I really wanted to read and leave you with, if I may. Because while it's about the freedom to create and to be creative, it's also about how we move through the world with acceptance for ourselves and others around us. And I find myself coming back to it more and more as I see so many people deal with things like imposter syndrome and elitism and the feeling that their particular spirit isn't enough, that who they are isn't enough. It's a book called Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. You might know her from Eat, Pray, Love. Right? Great. But this is a really fantastic book, and even if you don't do theater and you don't feel particularly creative, it's just a fabulous book about being a human being. So I'm just going to read this and kind of leave you with this. So this is Elizabeth Gilbert from Big Magic, and it's from the section called Walk Proudly. 20 years ago, I was at a party talking to a guy whose name I have long since forgotten, or maybe never even knew. Sometimes I think this man came into my life for the sole purpose of telling me this story, which has delighted and inspired me ever since. The story this guy told me was about his younger brother who was trying to be an artist. The guy was deeply admiring of his brother's efforts, and he told me an illustrative anecdote about how brave and creative and trusting his little brother was. For the purpose of this story, which I shall now recount here, let's call the little brother Little Brother. Little brother was an aspiring painter, and he saved up all his money and he went to France to surround himself with beauty and inspiration. He lived very cheaply. He painted every day. He went to museums. He traveled. He bravely spoke to everyone he met, and he showed his work to anyone who would look in it. And one afternoon, he's talking to someone in a cafe with a group of charming young people who turned out to be fancy aristocrats. So the young aristocrats really took a liking to him, and they said, you should come to this party this weekend at this castle in the Loire Valley. And they promised that this was going to be the most fabulous party of the year, and it was going to have tons of rich and famous people. They were going to be the crown heads of Europe. And best of all, it was a masquerade ball where nobody skimped on the costumes, and it was not to be missed. You've got to put on a costume, they said, and you've got to come join us. So really excited, little brother worked all week on a costume that he was sure would be a showstopper. And he looked all over Paris for materials, and he held back neither on the details nor the audacity of his creation. And then he rents a car, and he drives to the castle 3 hours from Paris. He changed into his costume in the car, and he ascended the castle steps. He gave his name to the butler, who found him on the guest list and politely welcomed him in. And he entered the ballroom head held high, upon which he immediately realized his mistake. This was indeed a costume party. His friends had not lied to him, but he had missed one detail in the translation. This was a themed costume party. The theme was medieval court, and little brother was dressed as a lobster. All around him, the wealthiest and most beautiful people of Europe were dressed in the finest of finery and elaborate period gowns and heirloom jewels and sparkling elegance as they waltzed to a fine orchestra. He was wearing a red leotard, red tights, red ballet slippers, and giant red foam claws, and his face was painted red. Now, this is the part of the story where I have to tell you that little brother is over 6 feet tall and quite skinny, but he's got a long waving antenna on his head, so he looks even taller, and he's the only American in the room. So he's at the top of the steps, and there's this one long, ghastly moment where he wants to run away in shame. And it seems like the most dignified response, but he doesn't run. Somehow he finds his resolve. He'd come this far, after all. He worked tremendously hard to make this costume, and he was proud of it. So he takes a deep breath, and he walks on the dance floor. He reported later that it was only his experience as an aspiring artist that gave him the courage and the license to be so vulnerable and so absurd. Something in life had already taught him to just put it out there, whatever it is. That costume was what he had made. So that's what he was bringing to the party. It was the best he had. It was all he had. So he decided to trust in himself, to trust in his costume, and to trust in the circumstances. As he moved into the crowd of aristocrats, a silence fell. The dancing stopped. The orchestra stuttered to a stop. The other guests gathered around little brother. And finally, someone asked him what on earth he was. So little brother bowed deeply and announced, "I am the court lobster." And they laughed, and there was no ridicule. It was just joy. They loved him. They loved his sweetness. They loved that he was weird. They liked the giant red claws, his skinny little butt in the bright spandex tights. He was the trickster among them, and so he made the party. He even ended up dancing that night with the Queen of Belgium. This is how you have to do it. I have never created anything in my life that did not make me feel at some point or another like I was the guy who had just walked into a fancy ball wearing a homemade lobster costume. But you must stubbornly walk into that room and you must hold your head high. You made it. You get to put it out there. Never apologize for it. Never explain it away. Never be ashamed of it. You did your best with what you knew. And you worked with what you had in the time you were given. You were invited, and you showed up, and you can't do more than that. They might throw you out, but then again, they might not. They probably won't throw you out, actually. The ballroom is often more welcoming and supportive than you could ever imagine. Somebody might even think you're brilliant and marvelous. You might end up dancing with royalty. Or you might just end up having to dance alone in the corner of the castle with your big, ungainly red foam claws waving in the empty air. That's fine, too. Sometimes it's like that. What you absolutely must not do is turn around and walk out. Otherwise, you miss the party. And that would be a pity, because please believe me, you did not go all that way and make all that effort only to miss the party at the last moment. Thank you for inviting me here today, and I hope you found the talk interesting.